Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us here on Tuesday. Golfers have probably been as eager to get out on the links as ever, given the long, intense winter that we are. Well, are we coming out of winter? I think we're coming out of winter. But unfortunately, a number of places in the state, a number of golf courses in the state, especially to the east of us, from what we are told, really have suffered some serious damage to the conditions of their greens in particular, as we understand it. We're going to learn more later this hour with a couple of guests, including Kevin Frank, who is one of the top turf specialists at Michigan State University. We know a thing or two about turf at MSU, and Kevin will join us to put that in some perspective. We visit with the LSO, and we take a trip to the UP before the hour is over as well. We're glad you're along. At the top of our program today, at the end of each month, we check in with Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson for updates on environmental stories from around the Great Lakes Basin. For today's Great Lakes Month in Review, we're focusing on the Council of Great Lakes Governors Summit, which took place in Chicago just this past weekend. Gary Wilson had the opportunity for a one-on-one interview with Governor Rick Snyder, and Gary joins us now from Chicago. Hi, Gary Wilson.
Good morning, and hopefully those greens will get back in shape over there. I know you got a lot of avid golfers.
That's right, and a lot of them are eager to get out there, but they're encountering some greens that are less than desirable here. The Council of Great Lakes Governors held their first summit meeting since 2005, just last year. This weekend's gathering marked the second. Remind us what the purpose of this council is, Gary.
Sure, Mark. The Council of Great Lakes Governors was founded in the mid-80s, and it's really got two roles, and they go back and forth depending on who's in leadership and various priorities. But they're about regional economic development, how the eight Great Lakes states, and they've also added the two Canadian provinces of Ontario and Quebec, but how those organizations can work together to better economic conditions in the region. And their other mission is related to the environment, generally sustainability and matching sustainability efforts with economic efforts. And their biggest accomplishment in the environment area was passing and signing the Great Lakes Compact, which is meant to keep water in the Great Lakes Basin. So that's their role, although they had been a little bit dormant in recent years until Governor Snyder decided to make it a priority to get them back in gear.
This year's meeting took place in Chicago over this past weekend. At it, you had the opportunity to sit down with Governor Snyder to ask for his thoughts on many of the issues that we have discussed here on Current State, including Asian carp. How did the governor suggest the region handle the invasive fish?
Sure, Mark. That's a tough one. Let's go back just a few months to January when the Army Corps of Engineers released its long-awaited report on how to handle Asian carp. And it's more than Asian carp. It's all aquatic invasive species in the region. As you remember, the best option was physical separation from the Great Lakes from the Mississippi, but that came with that big $18 billion price tag. And that had everybody, but especially elected officials, scratching their head. What do we do with this? So what you see in the region is a little bit of dancing around the issue, and I mean that in a positive way. I don't think they're trying to evade it, but they're just trying to figure it out. So when I sat down with the governor, I just asked him what his position was on physical separation, and I think you've got a clip there. Here's what he had to say.
It's clearly one of the solutions I could support, so I think that's a solution I have been supportive of. If people have alternatives, I'm open to looking at those, but we need to solve the problem. It's the bottom line. That's the real issue. The whole price tag question, it's amazing to see that variety of price tags. Hopefully we can do it as efficiently as possible. The other one, though, is the timing of all this. I mean, I appreciate the Army Corps of Engineers for their participation in this process, but it could be a more speedy participation.
So once again, the governor said there, it's clearly a solution I could support, referring to the physical barrier. All in all, Gary, what did you make of the governor's response?
Well, he talked about the necessity to be moderate in his language, the way he talks about it. He said he could support it. He is very sensitive to Illinois and Indiana's issues because it's the waterways in those two states that will be replumbed, and there's a lot of opposition there based on wreaking potentially economic havoc in those two states. So the governor doesn't want to come out and take a hard and fast position. He, you know, in fairness to him, he said it's easy for people in other states, be you an elected official or an environmental advocate, to say physical separation, that's the best solution, go do it. But the governor is also concerned about the reaction in Illinois. He doesn't want to, you know, advocate for anything that's going to not at least be received on some positive level in those two states.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about this economic havoc that they fear in Illinois and Indiana. Is he alluding to simply the cost of building and managing the barrier, or what?
Well, there's that, plus the it's long term. It will take a decade or more to do all this work. A lot of things can happen. But business interests, especially in Northwest Indiana, and the shipping interests that bring barges up the Mississippi and eventually into Illinois and especially Northwest Indiana, they are dead set against it. The transport of these goods to the steel mills and refineries and other industries in Northwest Indiana, they're very concerned about that. Some people say that's a false issue. The amount of revenue there isn't all that much in the big scheme of things, but especially Indiana is holding firm. They don't want anything to do with it.
Our Great Lakes Month in Review segment here features journalist Gary Wilson, who just returned from Chicago this past weekend, where he attended the Council of Great Lakes Governors Summit and spoke with Governor Rick Snyder. You also discussed Enbridge's Straits of Mackinac pipeline with the governor. His opponent in this upcoming election, Mark Schauer, has called for a full inspection of the pipeline by Enbridge. How does Governor Snyder feel about this?
The governor sees it differently. He's not necessarily opposed to a full inspection of the pipeline, but pipelines are regulated by the federal government. So Governor Snyder, he elected to defer to the federal government on the pipeline issue. He did tell me that Enbridge has a quotation here, a track record of success with this pipeline. I did remind him that Enbridge also had a failure in Kalamazoo, but he prefers, he saw Mark Schauer's proposal as being a little bit extreme, and he prefers being very diligent about the pipeline. He said his staff has been in contact with the federal government and expressed their concern, but he doesn't want to overreact, and he wants to give the federal government time and to work things out there. So he's taking a sort of a cautious approach, much more than Mark Schauer would.
How often should that, arguably, should that pipeline be inspected in the way that candidate Mark Schauer is calling for, and has it been a long time since such an inspection?
It's been a while, and I'm not sure what the guidelines are for that, but the pipeline is 60 years old. Governor Snyder did tell me that they've been working with Enbridge and a number of improvements have been made to it. So he's got some trust that he's put with Enbridge, but he has also promised to be diligent about it.
Last year, we discussed the storage of pet coke in southwest Detroit. These are the giant piles that were eventually removed. Now, a company wants to store petroleum coke in the city of River Rouge. What were Governor Snyder's thoughts on the storage of pet coke in these areas?
Well, he's concerned about pet coke storage wherever it may be. I mentioned it to him in the context of the stuff tends to end up in economically disadvantaged communities. And the governor was very candid. He said he's concerned about the storage there, wherever it may be, not just in economically disadvantaged communities. He wasn't. The city of River Rouge passed a proclamation saying that they are dead set against pet coke being stored in their city. The governor wasn't aware of that, but he's promised to check into it. And his concern is wherever it is. He understands that the fact that particulate matter could be damaging to people's health, so he's going to keep track of it.
It's important to note here that only three of the eight Great Lakes state governors attended this meeting this past weekend. Along with Governor Snyder, it was Illinois' Pat Quinn and Wisconsin's Scott Walker. Was this low attendance expected, and what does this mean?
Well, I'm not sure if it was expected, Mark, but it's certainly headed in what I would perceive to be the wrong direction. When Governor Snyder resurrected this group last year on Mackinac Island, only four of the eight governors attended. I thought five or six would have been a good turnout, but there were only four. That was credible, but I thought this year more would show up. There's nothing like having the chief executive from a state. Right, they did send senior staff, but there's nothing like having the chief executive there to put his or her signature on the process. I asked the governor about that, and I think you guys know that your governor is ever the optimist, and when he answered, he kind of had a wry smile on his face. He said, well, the lack of attendance is a chance to try to continuously improve. He likes to put a positive angle on things.
And he said, we've got a few of the governor's comments here ready to go. Let's listen to those.
I wouldn't want to be critical of it. I would rather say there's opportunities for continuous improvement to keep on doing better on this. And so that's where I was happy to say, you know, last year I was very proud to kick off the conference in Mackinac. It's great to be here in Chicago. Let's make sure we're doing something next year. Let's make sure we start putting some real dates to say, you know, here's some deadlines or real objectives to get done. Because, again, too often in the public sector world, people talk too much and don't have enough action.
And finally, Gary, what were some of the biggest takeaways from this year's meeting, and was anything overlooked at the gathering?
Well, the governors, they had two big press releases that they announced at a press conference on Saturday. One was a deal that they've struck with the Paulson Institute to help garner investment from overseas, specifically China, in the Great Lakes region. The Paulson Institute is going to help the governors and the states and the premiers try to bring much-needed foreign investment to the region. And the other issue on the environmental side was the announcement of a mutual aid pact related to fighting invasive species in the region. They're going to work together, rapid response issues, supporting each other with information. It's a positive thing, and I don't want to minimize it. But in fairness to the governors, you know, absent a solution for the bigger issue on what to do about Asian carp, they have to do something. So this is a good step in the right direction, but it's not the solution.
Hmm. We'll continue to keep an eye on it. Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes commentator and journalist. Gary, thanks for your time.
Mark, it's always good to be with you. Thank you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Well, if you're like me, you'd probably just like to forget about this past winter, but this very gradual spring we're having is making it difficult. As the warmer weather slowly arrives, we're just starting to get a more complete picture of winter's repercussions. And for many Michigan golf courses, especially in the eastern half of our state, the winter has been one of the worst on record. Here to help us get a sense of the damage to Michigan's links is Kevin Frank, an MSU associate professor and turf grass specialist. He's also joined by phone with by Brian Schweighofer. He's the golf course superintendent at Franklin Hills Country Club in Farmington Hills, Michigan. Kevin and Brian, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
Brian, how many greens are affected down there at Franklin Hills?
Well, every one of our greens was moderately affected. Some of them are recovering quickly, more quickly than others. Currently, we have 14 greens that are out of play. We were able to open up five of them for last weekend.
What do they look like?
Lots of patchiness, I guess you'd call it. Some areas of green and quite a few areas of brown and you know, dead turf.
Hmm. And what are you hearing from your colleagues at other courses in the area? Are they having similar problems?
Yes, quite a few courses in the area are having similar problems. Oddly enough, a few courses have escaped damage, which we're still mystified by to a certain extent. But I'd say the majority of courses in this area, Metropolitan Detroit, have suffered some type of damage, some worse than others.
So in the 20-plus years you've been doing this, can you give us a sense of just how bad this is?
I've never seen it like this. I've never even realized that it could get this bad, to be honest with you. I think I've heard stories of maybe early 80s it was this bad, but at that point I don't really remember it. And it's really severe.
Kevin Frank, is this the worst you've seen it?
Yeah, I've been on campus for 15 years now, and I was talking to one of the superintendents in the greater Detroit area that's been in his position for several years, and he was pointing back almost 40 years to when he thought the damage was possibly this severe.
What is happening from your point of view? Why are these greens in particular dying?
The biggest problem we had this winter was we had ice form on greens, and that happened somewhere around the end of December to about the 1st of January or so, and that ice literally was in some places 3-4 inches thick. I mean, basically it looked like a skating rink on top of these putting greens. And that stayed in place for better part of 70 days, which becomes a real problem for the turf being able to survive under that ice.
So they can survive snow. They cannot survive ice.
Yeah, snow, if it's just snow, even though, you know, we broke all sorts of records for days of snow cover this year, that's not a problem. But when you put ice on top of it, all of a sudden it's essentially like the plant and the soil can't breathe anymore. Everything is trapped under there, and that's basically, the plant almost suffocates to death is what happens.
So what are some of the options for superintendents like Brian?
I mean, at this point, you know, they're all about regrowing grass. You know, we've gone around. I mean, there's damage. There's different ways it might have died, but the bottom line is, in some cases, this grass is gone. Some is recovering, but they're basically regrowing greens, so it's kind of like starting over again.
Brian, when did you start to become concerned here? Did you know you had a problem midwinter or thereabouts, or what?
You know, all superintendents get nervous whenever there's ice on the greens, so some of us were nervous, you know, back in December when the ice formed. And then gradually throughout the winter, we became more and more nervous, per se, then all the way to, like, fear. So mid-January, we were concerned, and then ultimately in February, when we were approaching that 60-day window, we knew that there was going to be some severe repercussions.
Are there options that you have for dealing with this while it's happening? During the winter?
It's very difficult. This winter especially, we had 18 to 20 inches of snow on top of the ice. So a lot of us tried to go out there and do something, but that required removing the snow on basically 3 acres of green surface and then trying to remove that ice layer.
I heard that didn't stop people from trying. I guess people were using snow blowers on greens?
Oh, we were trying everything. We invested a lot of time and a lot of energy to try to do that. But in the end, we were unable to prevent the damage.
So tell us what you're doing now then.
Well, our club purchased covers, and we have covered the greens with this. It's a specialized fabric kind of designed for golf course greens, and it's a translucent woven poly material that allows air to transfer back and forth, but it almost acts like a greenhouse, trapping heat underneath it. So it allows us to grow grass just a little bit faster, and especially in a springtime that's, you know, cooler than normal.
Are you tearing up some of these greens and just starting over here, or how much grass have you managed to salvage?
Well, in each of the greens, there has, some grass has survived. We are seeding, adding seed to the areas that have, died. And some of the grass that's there is kind of filling in. So we're kind of growing grass in from a couple different directions. One, adding seed to what's left is spreading out and growing. So the covers and the seeding and all the work that we're doing is we hope to have greens ready to be back in action by, the first week in June.
Kevin, Frank, are you aware of preventative ways? Are preventative ideas being put on the table to address ice?
I mean, there's some ideas we've had, and certainly one that's the number one question everybody's asking now is, they've seen the damage. What are they going to do next year? And I don't know if we're going to get another winter like this. I mean, for most of us, this is the worst winter we can ever remember, but there are some thoughts that possibly some of these greens you can cover completely with a cover system similar to what Brian's talking about now, but that would actually prevent ice from forming on top of the greens. So that's a possibility. I don't think it's 100% foolproof. Sometimes we could actually have damage from covering greens like that, but that's a possibility. We're introducing a lot of bent grass into greens now. Most of our greens that were damaged are what we call annual bluegrass or poa annua putting greens. So reseeding with bent is possibly going to help us a little bit. That's basically between the two grasses, the poa died and the bent survived. And most of our older golf courses are really dominated by poa just because our growing conditions are so favorable for it in this state. And besides that, it's just everything we can do throughout the year to make the plant healthier, to give it a chance to get through a severe winter like we just emerged from.
We're talking with Kevin Frank, a turf grass specialist from Michigan State University, and Brian Schweighofer, golf course superintendent at Franklin Hills Country Club in Farmington Hills, about the damage done to golf courses due to the intense winter. Brian, are you looking at potential economic impact from the condition of your course?
Being a private club, we're a little bit insulated because we have, members, and we don't depend necessarily on daily fee golfers. However, there is an economic impact because we've purchased covers, purchased seed, invested a lot of time and effort into recovery. And, of course, we're going to have an impact on loss of revenue to golf and into the restaurant and those types of things. So definitely loss of revenue and definitely increased expenses. I think it's a much bigger problem for like a public course that depends solely on, cart and golf revenue for, their livelihood. So
you agree with that, Kevin?
Yeah, absolutely. I was on site at a public course last weekend, as the owner told me, and every golfer understands, playing temporary greens is not something that most golfers are interested in doing and paying a green fee for. So it's a huge issue for those public facilities.
Kevin, over the, last decade or so, have you had to take into account any effects of climate change into your work?
Yeah, it's kind of funny, I guess, from my perspective. I've been trying to do some winter kill research for on and off probably 10 years, and the biggest problem I've had is we haven't had a good winter. And we finally
got them all in 1 year.
Yeah, we got it all in 1 year. So it's kind of been the opposite, that in some cases we've looked at it and said, geez, we're having trouble replicating these types of events. And that was our biggest problem this year. We never got that sustained melt that we often do in sometime in January or February, which melts all the snow, melts all the ice, and kind of resets the clock for us.
Kevin Frank is an MSU associate professor and turf grass specialist, and Brian Schweighofer is the golf course superintendent at Franklin Hills Country Club in Farmington Hills. Kevin and Brian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for having us.
You're tuned to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A new book tells the story of what might be Michigan's most historic but little-known site, Capitol Park, in Detroit. It's where Michigan's first Capitol building was located, and the state's first governor is buried there. The triangular park is surrounded by old buildings that are being refurbished near the Westin Book Cadillac Hotel. Current state Scott Pohl paid a visit to the park to talk with Jack Dempsey, president of the Michigan Historical Commission.
I am in Capitol Park in downtown Detroit, a beautiful little park, and I should emphasize little, I suppose, but it's the subject of a book by Jack Dempsey called Capitol Park, Historic Heart of Detroit. And Jack Dempsey joins me here. Hi, Jack.
Hi, great to be here. Thank you.
What inspired you to write a book about this small park in the heart of Detroit?
I've been captivated by this story since 2007. I've worked in Detroit, born in Detroit, my parents born in Detroit, never really focused on this space, and someone tipped me off to it once I got on the Michigan Historical Commission, which has been a tremendous thing for me personally. And came over here and just electrified by the story of this park, how it's got tremendous history.
Well, when we arranged to meet here, you wanted me to meet you specifically in this spot. So tell me about this spot.
We're standing right in front of the statue and grave of Michigan's first governor as a state, Stevens Thompson Mason. He was also the last territorial governor, the boy governor. Great, amazing story of a young man who rose to position of public service very young, and then his fortunes receded. He did not run for re-election after two terms as governor of the state, moved to New York, and died very young. Years later, his remains were brought back here to this park in a tremendous ceremony, the statue funded by the legislature, and it's just an amazing sight right here.
Is there an explanation for why his body was brought to this specific place?
Yes, because this is the location of where Michigan's first Capitol building, its only territorial Capitol building, the same structure, existed. It was right here in this park. It was not a park per se then, but right on this ground is where our first Capitol was, where, as I say in the book, democracy flourished and took root here, and that's why they brought the remains back here and made it a focal point for thinking about our state's history.
And this little park is unique in this regard, isn't it?
It is unique. I am not aware of any other park like this in the country, where you have such a prominent leader, the state's first governor, actually buried. Looking around, I could not find another example like this.
This park, or this site, is also known for having been part of the Underground Railroad.
That's correct. There is a Michigan State Historical Marker here commemorating that the Finney Barn was located right across the street, and there's also a tablet on that building there on the corner. This is where escaped slaves made their way to freedom across the Detroit River into Canada. And the great story is that the proprietor who owned the barn owned an establishment, a tavern, a hotel, and slave catchers were put up in that hotel while he hid their slaves that they were trying to secure and take back south in the barn. So a great story there.
I'm sure record keeping is sketchy at best when it comes to this sort of thing, but do we have any idea how many slaves may have passed through here?
I don't believe we do. There's a great book written by Carol Mull about the Underground Railroad in Michigan. Part of the problem is because of the nature of that activity in the 1850s, actually against the law to hide fugitive slaves, record keeping was not done. So most of the accounts, I believe, are word of mouth passed down through generations.
Are there other historical things to see or to know about this site?
There's a lot of history with the buildings that surround the park. We're right behind the governor's statue is a building designed by Albert Kahn that's being renovated. The David Stott building, huge skyscraper, very tall and narrow. One of the few surviving skyscrapers from the 1920s. this Farwell building, which is in very sad shape, is being renovated. It was part of a land bank transaction. And actually, three of the buildings on the park have a Lansing connection in that the firm, the Richard Karp firm out of Lansing, is renovating three of these buildings, including the Farwell. So that's exciting.
Well, it's a beautiful little site, and I was going to say quiet, and yet with the construction, not particularly quiet right at the moment, but a nice little spot in downtown Detroit.
That sound is the sound of investment, which is exciting because this place has fallen on hard times after it was redone in the 1950s as a bus depot, essentially, and now at least we're making progress in calling people's attention to the heritage here. Plus, with the kind of the renaissance in Detroit that's going on, more investments coming to this location, and that's good. That's very good.
Well, people with an interest in Michigan history should certainly make a point of stopping by here sometime when they're in downtown Detroit, if only to see the burial site of former governor, first governor, Stevens T. Mason.
That's true. There are also some other historic things here. There's a new marker that the Michigan Historical Commission put up talking about the first state capitol and the fact that the building was repurposed into a school and public library after the capitol was moved to Lansing. Plus, there's a model of the state's first capitol over in that bed made of stainless steel that kind of gives you the impression of what that building looked like back in the 1830s, 40s. So there's a lot here.
Let's go over and look at that.
Great.
We've moved over a few paces, Jack, to a scale model of the first Michigan Capitol as it was on this site.
It's small, but I think it really gives you the idea of what that building looked like. Very iconic in terms of the architecture. And when you think about how on this site, Stevens T. Mason, other early government leaders set forth policy, this is where our first Constitution was drafted. It gives you the idea of this is where democracy in Michigan really had a home. And as I said earlier, where the seeds of our freedom were sown, with the Underground Railroad being another example.
There's a marker for the Capitol Union School. Tell me about that.
The building, once the Capitol was moved to Lansing, had to be repurposed, and it was decided to make it into a school. And so it was a high school in the 1850s, was renovated, I guess you'd say, redesigned into a different look from what you see here at the model. And then, as many historic structures, unfortunately, suffered from a fire, had to be torn down. So that's why you don't have the structure itself here anymore.
Is that when it was turned into a park?
Yes. The mayor, Hazen Pingree, who also became a governor of Michigan, was one of the key folks instrumental in making sure this stayed a public space, made into a park, therefore could be the site for where the governor's grave could be placed.
Do we have any artifacts from that original Capitol still in existence? What are they? Where would they be seen?
We do have artifacts, at least as far as documents that I'm aware of, and those would most likely be in the state archives in Lansing. There might be some also at the Bentley in Ann Arbor, perhaps here at the Detroit Public Library, the Burton. In fact, there's a document that was recently acquired by the archives, which is very historic. It's signed by Stevens T. Mason when Michigan was a territory, and we hope to have an unveiling, a demonstration, an exhibit of that here in this park at some point.
You think Stevens T. Mason would be pleased with what has become of this site?
I think he would be pleased to see that it's coming back, yes. The sounds of life here, of construction, of renovation, looking around and thinking about how the next few years are going to be very positive here, I think he would be pleased. Plus, if people will come here to realize what this place means, this is, in my view, holy ground where our democracy took root, I think he'd be very pleased with that.
Well, perhaps your book will spur some of that.
I certainly hope so. The whole point of the book is to teach, educate, enlighten, inspire, and if people come here because of the book, I'd be very gratified.
Jack Dempsey is the author of Capitol Park, Historic Heart of Detroit. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you so much, Scott.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Arthur Smith, the guitar legend, Boomerang. Remember, you can track the music you hear in between segments here on Current State by following us on Twitter. That's at KAR Current State. Coming up, Escanaba's Rite of Spring. It involves a pickup truck falling into a body of water. Stay tuned. The Lansing Symphony Orchestra closes out its regular season with an unusual Wednesday night concert tomorrow. Joining us with more about the concert, Current State's Melissa Benmark. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. I don't think there's any boomerang music, actually, on the program tomorrow night. But but a number of interesting things. Brahms' Final Symphony, what has been described as a near-viral modern composition in terms of popularity, and a piano concerto played by Andrew Hsu. He's a Gilmore Young Artist Competition winner, and yesterday I talked to LSO conductor Timothy Muffet about the soloist and the music.
We're very proud of our association with the Gilmore Competition. The Gilmore is one of the major piano competitions in the world, and it's right here in Michigan, and so it's wonderful for the Lansing Symphony to have our affiliation. And part of what we do is we promise the Gilmore that we'll present their winners. But by the time when we go to press with our season, we don't know who that winner is. So, but what we do know is that winner is going to be extraordinary, because they always are. So we had published our season, and it wasn't until the fall that we found out that it was Andrew Hsu. And then at that point, I work out the repertoire with the artist. Because especially, you know, these are young and up-and-coming people, so we can't really make a decision on repertoire and then say, well, you're going to play it. We want to do things that are really, that the artist is comfortable with as well.
So the Schumann Piano Concerto in A, where does that sort of stand in the world of piano literature?
The Schumann is part of the standard repertoire for pianists, and I really like it on this program because I love the Schumann and Brahms pairing. That strong personal connection between Brahms, the younger composer of the two, and Robert Schumann, and then of course Clara Schumann as well, and the three of them together. But there's a great stylistic link between Schumann and Brahms that I think really makes them work nicely on the program. Schumann was in a way the bridge. Probably the two strongest influences on Brahms' music would be Beethoven and Schumann. And then there was, of course, he had a great fascination with the gypsy culture, which appears in a lot of his music as well, even in some of the most highly refined musical utterances. There's still a little bit of gypsy in there. But I think there's just a great connection between the two, and they fit nicely together. The Schumann Concerto is quintessential first-generation romanticism in many ways, and really brings out Schumann's melodic gift and his wonderful sense of pianism, and it's a lovely concerto.
I wanted to back up a little bit and talk about the piece of music that you're starting with. It's called Rainbow Body, and not sure a lot of our listeners have necessarily heard of it. Tell us a little bit about that and about the composer.
Rainbow Body is a work by a living American composer named Christopher Theofanidis, and it's been really quite a phenomenon on concert stages across this country since it was written in 2000. So it's 14 years old now. But it's been just remarkably well received by audiences every time. It's a very uplifting piece of music, And it has its roots in, it has spiritual roots in two ways. The idea of rainbow body comes from the Tibetan Buddhist notion that when a person dies, that the soul is turned into energy and the energy is absorbed by the universe. And so there's this sense of uplifting and of renewal in the energy of the formerly living person and a new life. And so this is where the rainbow body idea comes from. The other kind of spiritual side of it is that the melodic material comes from some medieval chant. And I think that sense comes across very strongly in the music, that there's something very spiritual about the primary musical ideas. Interesting the way he writes the piece, too, that he writes in, of course, when we hear medieval chant, we're accustomed to hearing it in a massive cathedral, so there's this extraordinary reverberation and almost blurring together of the pitches. And the composer writes that into the music. So when the first note of the melody, one voice will continue to sustain that note while the next voice moves to the next note of the melody. And so there's this built-in cathedral-like reverberation in the music that's really an extraordinary effect. The composer just nailed it. And even musicians in the orchestra they're thinking, what is that effect? What is happening here? Is there, I had a violinist say, was the vibraphone playing along with us, and creating that effect? Was there some percussion instrument? And it's just the way it's written. It's really an amazing effect. But I have to tell you, there, if there was ever an equivalent of a work going viral in orchestral music, it's been this one. This has been just a total smash hit, and for great reason. It's a very powerful and uplifting piece.
And finally, you'll be doing the Brahms Symphony No. 4, and listening to it on the way into this interview, I was just struck by how, in some ways, it seemed very, very Beethovenian. And what it really reminded me of was Elgar, a little bit later composer. There's just such a richness to it. Talk about what it's like emotionally to take on this particular symphony.
Well, that's interesting, the Elgar connection. I can see that. I've not made it before, but I can see that connection. The Brahms symphonies are, and I probably even said this before when you and I have talked about Brahms, they to me are kind of like the Parthenon, that they have this sense, even though we know they were written by a man who got up in the morning and ate breakfast and combed his hair, but they are so sublime and so remarkably flawless that it's hard to imagine that there was a time when they didn't exist. It's hard to imagine that they're the work of a mortal, to me. There are not many pieces of music, or certainly bodies of music, as we would say in the case of Brahms, because most of his music falls into that category of just sheer perfection. And so for all of us, I think for the listener, for the performer, the opportunity to embrace a Brahms symphony is one that we take with great reverence, and there's also a little bit of intimidation, even for those of us that have done these symphonies many times. When you come back to one of these works, that it really is, you feel like you've been entrusted with an enormous responsibility. And, I feel that way about every piece of music I do, but the responsibility is cranked up a bit when you work with the music of Brahms.
Well, that makes a lot of sense in light of Brahms really feeling like he needed to, like he was under great responsibility to carry on the tradition of Beethoven in terms of symphony writing.
That's exactly right. And Beethoven, I wouldn't say those things about Beethoven. Now, Beethoven obviously was an extraordinary composer and a revolutionary composer, but there's sometimes patchiness in Beethoven, and maybe not in the string quartets. Those are flawless, but even in some of his other works, there you can see the humanness in it, And in Brahms, I don't ever find that. I just find this unbelievable, almost divine-like creation.
So just in the couple seconds we have left, what are your musical plans for this summer?
Well, this summer I'll be going back to the Chautauqua Institution, which is always an exciting time for me and my family. And my wife will be going with me and my children will be there. And it's a time of very intense work, concerts and rehearsals almost every day. But in the same way, it's a very renewing experience each time.
Timothy Muffet, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And here at Current State, we see our fair share of curious news headlines. The most intriguing in a while appeared just Sunday in the Lansing State Journal. It proclaimed, "Truck falls through ice, woman wins $1,600. Our journalistic instincts primed, we are on the story. It turns out that Escanaba, Michigan's icebreaker contest is becoming a rite of spring in the Upper Peninsula community. Organizers haul a stripped-down pickup truck out onto the frozen surface of Little Bay Dinock, and the wagering begins. When will the ice give way? When will this stripped-down Ford sink to the bottom? Toby Quivenin is president of the Bark River Lions Club and one of the organizers of Escanaba's icebreaker contest. Hi, Toby. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Just great, thank you. How many years has Escanaba held this event?
This is our fourth annual in 2014.
And we'll also point out that the pickup does not include an engine with oil and antifreeze to pollute the water. Ostensibly, this is a green vehicle. Are people good at predicting when this thing is going to crash through the ice?
This year, we had it to the exact minute. This is the first year we've had somebody pick that.
Wow.
And it should have lasted about two more weeks, but we had a Coast Guard cutter that came through and chopped the ice up around, so it was a pretty lucky guess.
I guess
that Coast Guard cutter sent it through pretty early.
I guess so. Does it begin falling through the ice and then take hours or even days to crash all the way through?
Yeah, every year it's a little different, but yeah, typically it takes up to about a week. We thought maybe last Sunday it was going to go through, and it lasted till Thursday.
Thursday, 3:13 p.m. and 25 seconds. And your winner guessed 3:13, I guess, on the money. When and how do you get this thing out onto the ice?
Every year it's a little different. Last year when we put it out, there was 6 inches of ice and no snow, so we just towed it out there with a little Ranger side-by-side. This year we had 36 inches of ice and probably 3 feet of snow, so it wasn't so easy. We had a tracked vehicle that we had to pretty much drag it out there with.
And what is it like fishing it out of the water every year? How do you do that?
Oh, well, we put on a show. We've got our search and rescue team that goes down and verifies when, you know, they do their it's called a deep water recovery, so they do practice every year with this. And then they've got airbags this year where they'll just float it to the top. And then we've got a big local tow company, Gene's Towing, that hooks up a big crane, and we kind of lift it up in the air and whirl it around a little bit, put on a little show, and bring it to the shore and give away our monies and our prizes.
Boy, it's a production from start to finish. How deep is the water it's in?
It's on a very sharp incline, so it's anywhere from 20 to 35 feet, depending on where it ultimately lands.
Now, I'm thinking the longer you wait to enter, the better your chances, I imagine, because you can just track the weather and you could track how much ice there is out there. Do you have a deadline for entries? Is that it?
Yes. We have, this year we cut it off a week before. Next year we're going to probably cut it off. You know, it's hard because Mother Nature's so difficult to predict. You know, and we like selling tickets, but, you know, they're $2 a ticket. So really, even if you, and it all goes to local charities. So even if you guess too early, you know, it's not a big expense to buy a ticket. So a lot of people buy them throughout the year. They'll start in February and buy 10 in February, 10 in March, 10 in April, and then we cut it off.
Well, once again, it crashed through the ice officially at 3:13 p.m. and 25 seconds last Thursday. Do you require entrance to go down to the second, or will you?
Yes.
Okay, because there's just... It sounds like you've got...
Actually, sorry on that. No, it's to the minute.
To the minute.
To the minute, yes.
And Cheryl Ullman was 25 seconds off here last Thursday. Cheryl gets a little bit of money for her feat, but also your take also underwrites charitable activities from the Bark River Lions Club?
Correct.
This whole
fundraiser started because our Bark River Lions Club, we're a race group. We put on two races every year, two pro races, called the Torque Series off-road races. Very large, you know, races that only professional drivers, and, you know, we do have some sportsmen, but it's pretty much a pro race.
Whose brainstorm was this, Toby?
This one was mine, unfortunately.
And does anyone video the moment? That sounds like entertaining viewing.
We've got more people down there. Our park is busier than it is for the rest of the year. It's pretty much the largest social event of Delta County for the year. And it is live right now. You can actually, I shouldn't say live, but we do have the filming of the truck falling through at barkriveroffroad.com. So you can actually just click on that website, and it shows the icebreaker as it falls through the ice and what happens.
BarkRiverOffroad.com if you want to check that out. Toby Kuivinen is president of the Bark River Lions Club and one of the organizers of Escanaba's Icebreaker Contest. Thanks, Toby.
Thanks much. Have a great day.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, it's time for Month in Review. Our panel of journalists, including WKAR-TV's Tim Skubick, will break down April's biggest stories. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment features Wild Ones, a not-for-profit environmental education and advocacy group. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth, our producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.